Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode here at the Damage Report. Very lucky to be joined today, and actually in a timely fashion, considering that we are in the closing moments, potentially the closing days at least of the Derek Chauvin trial, that we are going to be joined once again today by Charles Coleman Jr. Charles, how's it going?
John, good morning. It's so glad to be here. Thanks for having me back. Really glad to be here joining you today and co-hosting.
Very glad to have you here. Wondering what's going to end up happening in the trial, which is going to be our leadoff story in a little bit. We were talking before the show, and things are very hectic. But yeah, we'll have to see. We'll have to see. But we're going to get into it in just a second. But there's a lot of other stories that we're going to be talking about as well throughout the course of today. It is the Green New Week. Multiple different facets of the Green New Deal unveiled. We're going to be breaking down several of those. DC statehood gets a big endorsement, so we'll talk about that. And then we're gonna dive into anti-vaxxers and vaccine hesitancy a little bit, and try to figure out who might be contributing to that. If you've been watching the show, you might be able to answer that question already. Finally, AOC gets defended by James Carville, sort of. And the defense is worse than an attack, kind of. But anyway, we've got all that and more. Wanna thank everyone who's already here and tell you that you can, of course, as always, hit the like button and share the stream so that people know we're active. And as we go through, if you have comments or tweets or concerns or anything like that, you can post them to us and Charles and I will respond. In addition, after the show at 12 p.m. Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern time, we're gonna be having our monthly live Q&A for our tier 3 YouTube members. So that is available if you'd like to become a tier 3 member, you can take part in that later on today. But other than that, Charles, you ready to jump into this thing?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. Okay. We are near the end of the Derek Chauvin murder trial. As of yesterday, the jury of 5 men and 7 women began deliberating. They did that throughout yesterday afternoon. And as we are filming this, they're back in deliberations, being sequestered from the public during this process. If you are coming into this trial not having followed it much, understand that the prosecution's case featured 38 witnesses. We have the defense calling 7 witnesses, notably not Chauvin, as he invoked his Fifth Amendment right not to testify. And so, Charles, we talked about this case earlier on in the process, but I wanted to get your updated thoughts as the jury is deliberating. What do you think about some of the developments, including the Chauvin pleading the fifth?
Well, I'm not surprised that Chauvin pled the fifth. That was kind of sort of expected. I did not necessarily know whether his attorney was going to be able to humanize him in a way that was going to make it advantageous for him to take the stand in front of the jury. If you notice, there were a few things that his attorney did try to do during summation that tried to sort of make him softer and gentler and appear to be different than the person that we've been watching on that video since last year. One of the things that people may have noticed was that during summation, that was literally the first time during the trial for any extended amount of time that the jury saw Derek Chauvin without his mask. That was the first time that they saw entire face, and that was a very deliberate but subtle move from the defense counsel, because they wanted, Mr. Nelson wanted them to see him in a different capacity. They wanted to sort of look at the person who was sitting at the defense's table, and then also look at the person who was being depicted on that video and sort of see whether there was any sort of sense of recalcitrance or remorse or difference during that time. And so that's something that I noticed that was very interesting. In terms of their general approach to the case, before we spoke, well, since the last time we spoke, we had not seen the defense or heard their case or really like allowed them to get into their arguments. I wasn't impressed. I think that they went into their case with about 3 distinct areas of their argument. And their case was built on 3 different principles. The prosecution, however, at every single point did an absolutely brilliant job of taking those things away from the defense so that they didn't really have them to rely on. And the result was a closing argument that was, quite frankly, all over the place. I mean, it rambled a lot. It was almost as though they were trying to throw everything on the wall and see what stuck. But here's the thing that I think viewers need to understand. The prosecution and the defense in this case have 2 very, very distinctly different approaches and desires for outcomes. The prosecution is looking for a home run. They want a conviction. Ideally, they want a murder two conviction. They will be happy with a murder three. And of course, they will settle for a manslaughter conviction. But ultimately, they want the home run of a conviction, which requires a unanimous verdict from the jury. Everyone has to be on the same page. The defense wants a bunt, at best a single. The home run for them is an acquittal. They know that that is not possible. They know that that is not going to happen. So what they are aiming to do is to target one or two jurors that they can distract or get to believe enough of what it is that they're offering in order to have a hung jury. And that's the difference in terms of the approach. It's also the difference in terms of the desired outcome that's really important to understand.
Can I have a few questions as someone who's the exact opposite of an expert on this, about you saying that it's impossible for them to get an acquittal. So how exactly would that work? Is it that, are they going to have to consider different charges in turn with like sort of the threshold dropping, or like how would it work that in theory, if they can't get the entire jury on board, is it-
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Why is it not possible that they might not be able to get them on board for literally any of these charges?
Well,
or is it just unlikely?
I think when I say impossible, I think it's highly unlikely that you're going to get 12 jurors who will be in agreement that of the three charges that Derek Chauvin is facing, all 12 believe that of the three, he's not guilty of anything. Mm-hmm. So understand that in order for there to be an acquittal, there has to be a unanimous verdict there, the same way that there has to be a conviction. So you can get a holdout for an acquittal the same way you can get a holdout for a conviction. And I just find it highly improbable that you're gonna get 12 people who have sat through this entire trial who are gonna go in there and say, he did nothing, and yeah, we're gonna let him off. I just don't see that happening. Mm-hmm. I see a hung jury as being a far more realistic scenario than an actual outright, like unanimous acquittal. I just don't see that.
Interesting. Okay. One of the bits of breaking news this morning in the trial was that the attorney for Derek Chauvin motioned for a mistrial, bringing up Representative Maxine Waters' recent comments, which we talked about on the show yesterday. That was denied by the judge, but the judge did seem to imply that the comments from the congresswoman might play into an appeal, and that in theory, were there to be a guilty verdict here, that the comments from Maxine Waters over the weekend might result in that guilty verdict being overturned in the future. I don't know if you saw that as it was happening, but what do you think about those possibilities?
I think that Auntie Maxine needs to mind her words at a time like this, not necessarily because I think that it is deeply problematic. I just think that we don't want to give any sort of reason at all for something that could be not necessarily a mistrial, as the judge has already ruled on that, but ultimately viewed as either reversible error or something like that. I understand that Recently, President Biden weighed in on the case as well. Also a bad idea. Here's the thing. The jury has been sequestered and instructed not to consume any news whatsoever. So that is the backstop that the judge has created to sort of shield off any accusations of unfair prejudice or undue prejudice against the defendant for something like this. However, what we don't want to see happen is somebody gets a whiff of that and then it becomes a conversation in the jury deliberation room. Of course, the judge has given instructions in accordance with the law, but what I can tell you from actual experience is that that doesn't always hold up. It doesn't always happen in that way. And so because of that, you just want to not leave things up to chance. And so while I can appreciate the vigor of Congresswoman Waters, I just think in this situation, it's something that I feel like she should have stayed away from. You know, we're just too close to the finish line. I don't disagree with her sentiment. I don't have a problem with what she said. I just think that the stakes are simply too high to have put that where it is right now.
Sure. One thing I wanted to mention though, because in our coverage of the comments yesterday, we talked about the way that Fox News was sort of obsessively focusing on them. And we occasionally will analyze when there's news that's from the perspective of a right winger to be inconvenient, the right will sometimes, Fox News will sometimes come up with a weird angle on it. More often, they just don't talk about the news if it's inconvenient. They didn't talk about the second impeachment trial very much on Fox. They didn't talk about the Capitol attack as it was happening very much. And actually, I saw this morning data from the Stanford Cable News Analyzer. Throughout the course of this entire month, Fox News, up until the end of the weekend, had talked about it for 4.2 minutes. Like the Chauvin trial, the trial that caps off a year of this social movement, they had been silent, but not since the Maxine Waters comments. It has been nonstop about Maxine Waters. So it's just, you know, I like political communication, I like passion. It's good to see that they got their passion back for this story, sort of. They can find an inroad to actually talk about it now.
Well, you know, I find that very interesting, especially from a credibility standpoint, you know, for a news organization to devote so little time to the story when arguably this is the biggest trial on a criminal level that we have seen, particularly as it relates to police misconduct ever. I would argue that this is bigger than OJ. And the reason why I say I think it is bigger than OJ. But that was a civil trial and it wasn't involving police misconduct. I think that this is bigger than the Rodney King trial. And I think it's bigger than the Rodney King trial because it's global and it has global implications. And we have seen so many different instances of misconduct in so many different cases that the entire world is tuned in to the outcome of this trial to try to understand, are you guys gonna do this again? So I think that like this is the biggest trial of its nature that we've seen. And I'm just kind of surprised, wink, wink, that a news organization has decided that it's not newsworthy enough for them to cover. Because I'm just kind of wondering, so what's the bigger story that you, or stories that you are finding? It's not surprising to me that Maxine Waters' comments have been politicized in a way that they have seized upon, of course, it's bait. But the fact that they have devoted so little coverage to the actual trial itself, it should be very telling for what we already know about Fox News.
Yeah. And, you know, as I alluded to in the intro to the show, we were talking a little bit about this before, and you made some great points about how there's this sort of like super high profile case. And like the best case scenario, I forget the exact analogy you made, but it was something about that it's like there's a fear that people will treat it as some sort of ceiling when it really should be the floor.
Right.
That like the best that can be done is what rationally should be the obvious expectation. Like that might not even happen. And that's I don't know. I feel dread basically because we've been through cases similar to this, maybe not as high profile nationally or internationally as you point out, where no, the rational thing didn't happen. And so it's a weird feeling to like be mentally stretching towards something that should be automatic.
Yeah, you know, people have sort of made this a one-off, John, and they've kind of sort of, I know someone used the analogy to me and said, you know, George Floyd is, you know, he's a one of one. And I was just like, what planet have you been on? He's absolutely nothing of the sort. And the reaction that I gave was rooted in the fact that, like, ostensibly, I would challenge you or any of your viewers to draw clear and strong distinctions between George Floyd and Eric Garner, right? Like, what's the difference there? Draw a difference between George Floyd, Eric Garner, Alton Sterling, and Walter Scott. All caught on video. Terrence Crutcher, all caught on video, right? Like, instance after instance after instance. So while we have, in somewhat of a degree of hopefulness, attached this weight to this case as though it is the gold standard of American jurisprudence and justice, we should be clear that this is not our ceiling, it is our floor. Yeah. If it takes a man in the prone position, already in restraints, not resisting, being killed on camera in broad daylight with a police officer's knee on his neck, if it takes all of that for us to secure a conviction, and that's sort of the bar that we're setting, then black lives do not matter to the degree that folks are saying. Mm-hmm. And I think that folks need to be honest about that and be very, very clear about that in terms of how we contextualize and what type of weight and perspective we attach to where this case sits in the sort of pantheon of justice and jurisprudence around police and state sanctioned violence against black bodies.
Yeah. And you know, as we've talked about, I'm sure you've been brought on cable news to talk about the fact that, like, the, you know, the final days of the deliberation and the actual case were going on, we have multiple high profile instances of fatal police brutality, including against children. Like, it's sort of a reminder that no matter what happens in this particular case, no matter which charge ends up sticking or not, yeah, no, we're in a bad situation. It is not a solution. It is at best, well, it's not as bad as it might have been.
And I think, John, you know, I thought about the different outcomes of the verdict and what that would mean and what we would take away from that. And, you know, on one hand, I think if you look at the jury of a micro, as a microcosm of American society, I think it's important to understand that, like, if it is a hung jury, then we have to, as a collective, understand the weight that the few of us can place on the whole of us. And what I mean by that is the same way that one person can stand in the way of justice in front of an entire jury, a small but loud and powerful minority that intends to stand in the way of progress in America can do just that. And so I think oftentimes we have the idea that, like, we have enough people on board, and so we're, our work is kind of sort of done. And I think that, by way of analogy, a hung jury is indicative of the fact that, like, no, that's not the case. The fight is very much so still ongoing and very real, because that one person, that small majority by extension, has enough impact where it can still do harm to the whole. It can still stand in the way as a barrier toward justice. Then I think we have to understand that. Similarly, if we have a conviction on manslaughter, that is a modified win, as far as I'm concerned. It's a moral victory, in as much as the overwhelming majority of police officers who are responsible for killing individuals while in the line of duty are never prosecuted. And those who are prosecuted are never convicted. So to that extent, sure, it is a win, but ultimately, that does not in any way, shape or form account for literally centuries of injustice against black bodies and people of color in America.
Yeah.
And so I think that, like, perspective is absolutely critical when we talk about this case, what it means and, you know, where we go from here.
Okay, well, we will continue to follow up in future days. For now, we are going to turn in a few minutes to more news. But before that, I want to see what's going on in the audience. There is a theme So the comments we're getting today on the 20th of April, Tails says happy 420, John, and all the stoner dragons out there. Joseph says 420 was thought to be the call sign marijuana. I don't get that reference, but thank you for the super chat. I do appreciate that. Franklin Sharpslicer says, I know it must get old. All the news is like an inconvenient mold, but we address it all head on. From margarine migraine to QAnon, with wisdom to fixo, flush the green laser sickos, breathe. Thank you, Franklin. Nutritionist Liz, welcome to tier 1 YouTube membership, as well as Chris and Suzanne, welcome to tier 2. Our top 10 list from yesterday, where Francesca and I break down our top 10 favorite comedians of all time, as of right now at least, is now up. People seem to enjoy it. Feel free to go in the comments and argue with us about why we are wrong, who we left out. Law school stud says, from one attorney to another, please consider making Charles Coleman a mainstay on TDR. His perspective and insight is so well informed. Thank you, law school stud. Very nice.
Thank you, law school.
And we're very lucky to have Charles. Let's see. Over on Twitch, Kin of Wolf gifted a tier 1 sub. Trimu Batiki did as well. Thank you to both of you. Dragon Penny gifted 1. Sarah did as well, and Similin the Kind Dragon gifted 5 subs. Thank you so much to all of you for expanding the community over on Twitch. The Comfy Shirt subscribed for the 5th month. Zuna2 for the 8th. Let's see, Central Committee for 9 months. Hey, Central Committee, how's it going? Over here on TDR, good to see you. Kerner for 6 months, and Mandy Rock a Fire Dragon for 5 months. Thank you to all of you. I saw Jess Freakin' Ortega highlighted a message, happy 420 Dragon Squad from Canna Dragon. It is truly your day, Jess, so thank you for that. That said, why don't we jump back into some news? We're gonna mix it up for a little bit. This week is sort of Green New Week, at least in my mind, with multiple different facets of the Green New Deal being introduced, as well as the Green New Deal itself being reintroduced in a live stream that was ongoing before we started and might still be active as we're shooting this. We'd love to be watching this, but the show goes on. That said, we do have the Green New Deal for public housing that was introduced by Senator Bernie Sanders and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. It would provide $172 billion to retrofit existing housing. Its proponents estimate that it would invest at least triple the amount that Mr. Biden has proposed to tackle a large backlog of improvements to the nation's aging public housing system. And in fact, would provide grants to retrofit all 950,000 of the country's public housing units, upgrade building electrification and water quality. As well, it would repeal the Faircloth Amendment, which restricts the building of new public housing developments. One of those little bits of government that seems so maddening and yet understandable from a sick point of view why they chose to do that. Anyway, we have a little bit more information about how this will be administered, some of the worker protections that are linked into it. But Charles, I wanted your thoughts on this Green New Deal for public housing.
I think that, you know, AOC, Bernie, and everybody else who's responsible for putting this together have done a great job in terms of thinking about reimagining what our future looks like, what community looks like, and what real sustainable alternatives in terms of housing looks like. This is the appropriate investment being made in certain communities. This is an appropriate investment being made in job creation, good job creation, union jobs that are going to result, you know, in terms of helping to support this. And quite frankly, you know, at like a 30,000 foot level, I like this because when Joe Biden was elected, there was a very clear message sent by hard left progressives to say basically like, hey, you're on the clock. And you know, you got here because of us. In part because we decided to play ball, and you're going to be under pressure. And something like this puts the moderates and like centrists in terms of the Democratic Party under pressure because they have to sort of get on board and deliver, because we all know that a significant part of Joe Biden's administration is going to rub off on Kamala Harris as someone who is likely going to be a one-term president. So the relationship that this administration has with the far, far left, if you will, is going to really have an impact in terms of how well or how poorly they set Kamala Harris up for a run, presuming that she is going to be the candidate during the next presidential election cycle. And so this is what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to ask for everything and get a few things maybe and figure that out. And so I think the vision is smart. I think it's aligned with what Democratic policy and politics are supposed to be about. This is something that I think speaks to what people who are generally aligned with the Democratic Party expect. And I applaud them for doing that. And I think that, you know, again, the gamesmanship that's involved with introducing this at a time when Joe Biden is talking about infrastructure and sort of trying to be aligned with this makes a lot of sense. And it's smart. And I'm curious to see how it plays out. Obviously, I don't expect everything that is proposed in the deal to get passed, but I do want to see what remnants of it or what it looks like as we go forward, where there is room to sort of move some things around and maybe tone some things down, and then what of this bill or of this sort of plan becomes the non-negotiables. So I'm very interested in seeing how this plays out.
Yeah, I agree. Timing wise, I think it's a great idea. The infrastructure bill is in the public consciousness, but not yet. Like, we're not in the thick of it yet. So there's time to influence the opinion of people, get them on board with this. As you said, it is pressure not only on Biden, but also on the centrists. And that's where I wonder, like, this is, after all, $172 billion of government money going to help people who need it most, which is not typically what the government likes to do or what our Senate likes to do. So hard sell, obviously, and not just for Republicans, but you know, Joe Manchin, the guy who just understands the downtrodden. I have a feeling he'll probably find a way to have a problem with this, and Kyrsten Sinema will probably be right there with him. So we'll have to see, but still, you have to put it out there. You have to put pressure on people, and hopefully that will work. I also liked your point about Kamala Harris. Not only that she's almost certainly going to run, but it would seem like both based on her 2016 experience, or sorry, her run in 2020, that she's definitely going to pitch herself as more progressive than Joe Biden. And it makes sense pragmatically too, because she doesn't need really to pitch herself as, you know, this like dependable centrist establishment Democrat. She's already the VP. She can sort of like get rid of those people with that. She would want to ward off some sort of primary challenger from the left. So exactly. In theory, if I were her, I'd want to spend the time between now and the run really trying to burnish those credentials. Like, we have the Green New Deal for public housing. We're about to turn for the Green New Deal for cities. There is, after all, the full Green New Deal. She should want to be involved in all of this. But so far, at least, it's only a couple months into the presidency. I haven't really seen her much. I know that she just took a trip to the border, but other than that, she's been kind of in the background.
Well, I think a big part of what they may be trying to figure out is, you know, where does her voice have the greatest impact in a way that doesn't become a distraction or a liability? I mean, the administration's priority coming in was clearly COVID, which is understandable, and getting that under control. The vaccine rollout wasn't necessarily the smoothest in the world and has been met with mixed reviews. The economy is continuing to improve and stabilize. And so I think that in terms of what the core issues are, there's sort of like a balancing act. And not to mention that, like, for most presidents, as compared to most presidential administrations, there were some very slow goings around appointments being approved and confirmed, just in terms of infrastructurally around government. And so I think when you look at that, that administration has really been thinking about where do we want her to make her initial splash, her initial mark, in a way that is going to help the administration, not hurt her, and not necessarily be a barrier to a critical issue. But, you know, as the old saying goes, you think too long, you think wrong. And so at some point, it is important that she gets in the mix in a meaningful way. And I don't necessarily know that there's pressure on her at this point. However, I think you make some very good points about the cost of this Green New Deal and the rollout there. not just with respect to housing, but with respect to cities and the overall thing. It's not just a Republican versus Democrat ideology thing. That's a hefty bill. And it's a great vision, but you gotta sell it. Like, you gotta be able to sell it, because, you know, even for the most leftist among us, people are already asking, this is great, but who's gonna pay for it? And so I think the Biden administration, especially Kamala Harris, before sort of engaging this particular passion point or policy point, has to really think about, if I do align myself with this or I am involved in this, is this the right move? Because A, it's going to create a direct attack on me as a spendocrat, as you know, folks will say. Or B, if I am trying to be the voice of reason in a room with AOC and Bernie and other hard left progressives, and I seem too centrist, that could potentially come back to bite me in the behind when folks are talking about the fact that I wasn't progressive enough in conjunction with this Green New Deal. And so, you know, reasonable minds may be able to disagree about whether she should weigh in on this in particular.
Well, we mentioned the Green New Deal for cities, so I do want to give people a little bit of information about that. It was introduced yesterday by Representative Cori Bush and AOC. It's a $1 trillion plan to tackle the environmental injustices that are making us and our children sick, costing us our homes and destroying our planet. The congresswoman had a tweet talking a little bit about what it does, including creating hundreds of thousands of good paying union jobs, clean air, removal of lead paint and pipes, which thankfully removal of lead pipes is actually a part of the current infrastructure bill that I hope makes it through, but this is America, so God only knows. So that's a part of it as well. I agree that you totally have to sell it. Biden, he wants us to believe that he's ready to be FDR 2.0. Well, this is the sort of thing that FDR 2.0 would do, is selling a plan like this. And personally, I would say I want a Democratic Party that is running in the midterms, that eventually the nominee is gonna run in 4 years, on a big package of bold legislation. Because the Republicans are going to be running on a combination of somebody canceled me and Dr. Seuss, and that's gonna be pretty much it. I mean, really in 2000, Trump literally didn't have a platform. They didn't pass a platform at the RNC. Multiple times he'd be asked what he wanted to do and he had nothing. And I don't know that like nominee Gates in 4 years is gonna have much more. And I think people are hurting. They're still gonna be hurting from, you know, not just the pandemic, the economic damage that's being done during the pandemic, but God knows what crises are gonna happen between now and the next 3 years. And I would rather have the Democrats risk being, you know, called spendocrats or whatever, than run like the Republicans, where it's just, it's something about the border. And that's pretty much it, not even acknowledging, let alone attempting to solve the many problems that people are experiencing. But we'll see. We'll see what Harris's strategy is.
I tend to agree with you. I think that for a very long time, one of the biggest points of frustration that I've had, along with some people who I know, with Democratic Party politics is that there has not been a clear agenda. There has not been a clear platform. Mm-hmm. Regardless of whether that was like actual policy or even ideology. I mean, I think that Democrats were heavier on ideology, even as that may not have been clear entirely, but very sort of light on policy in terms of what their priorities were. And the thing that Republicans have done very, very well over the past few election cycles is that they have found a way to have everyone on board, even if what they're on board about is trash. So like, even if it's like, America first, everything Anglo-Saxon, this is what we want to do. That's what everybody's on. And it's very, very clear what their message is. And I, you know, did a test on a number of different occasions during the 2016 election cycle, and then even during the most recent 2020 election cycle, where I asked people, what is the Democratic platform? What is the Democratic message? And it wasn't entirely clear. Most people who were casually involved in electoral politics did not know. There was not any unified message. And even if it is something as simple and equally nefarious as Make America Great Again, there has to be some level of a centralized message that is connected to policy. And so to that extent, I do agree with you. The Democrats do need something that they're going to be able to sort of wrap around, sell, push, and be unified on in terms of walking into that election. I think it's a much better strategy.
Yeah. Well, we've got other stories we're going to turn to. I want to read just a few super chats before I do so. Let's see. Andar says, it's my birthday and I'm blazed. Seems like a great time to spend $7 Canadian to say hail the Dragon Squad. Love Swedish Sativa Dragon. Thank you, Andar. I appreciate that. Ellen says, so happy with my Green New Deal t-shirt. Thankful I found you. Can I be thankful, Dragon? Well, you appear quite thankful, so it checks out and we will allow it. Thank you. Dragon Dancer says, happy Green New Week, Dragon Squad. Here's some money for catching you live. Good to have you here. Thank you. Rhino Wiki says, do you think Justice Dems are failing to hold the line and make demands like Manchin and others do? Should they do what the Tea Party did to get policy changes? Well, look, I think the Tea Party did a lot of different things over multiple years and lots of different members. I don't think that's one thing. I think that they are doing things. I think that we can certainly expect more. I think more direct confrontation with those could potentially be good. The issue is one of leverage. What leverage does AOC have over Manchin? Maybe we can come up with something. We can't, but it is difficult. I mean, Manchin feels emboldened because he is in a position of great power, singularly more powerful, not only because he's a senator, but because he can be the one who sinks it. He's not the only one. Sinema and a couple of others have that position and feel safe to exercise it. So I don't disagree at all that they need to be strategizing, coming up with something, but we also can acknowledge that it is a difficult position. Where individually and even collectively, they don't necessarily have the same level of power as someone like a Manchin. Not least of which because the vast majority of them are not in the Senate. But it's a good point. Thank you for raising it. Let's see. Over on Twitch, Dragon Song Yesy gifted a tier 1 sub, which Kerner did as well. Thank you for that. Mo Boogie subscribed for the 6th month. Let's see. Pray for Ripley did for the 2nd month. Thank you to both of you. Socrates Bartender said, got my first Pfizer jab 2 hours ago and I'm enjoying my direct mental access to all my wireless devices. Looking forward to my second, where I will either join the Borg Collective or be fully set up for all the latest cyber tech. By the way, Charles, I did a story on the pre-show today where there's memes going around saying that vaccination alters your DNA, so you're no longer a human. You're some new kind of race, and so we should be afraid of them mixing with the non-vaccinated. Which is horrifying in several different ways.
This is like that mini series that you may recall. It was popular when we were kids in the 80s. V. So like we're all like you take the vaccine and now beneath the surface we are all like reptiles.
Exactly.
You know, but here's the thing though. I do have to have a point on this. I do have to say a word on this. I feel like the notion of capitalism and media gain has distorted the discussion and dialogue around this issue in a way that has fertilized the ground for this sort of misinformation, confusion, lack of cohesion around ideas of what we can trust and not to trust. And I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. When the Johnson & Johnson story broke, it was literally breaking news. We interrupt, you know, what's currently going on in order to bring you this story about Johnson & Johnson's vaccine being halted in terms of production and distribution because we are aware of 6 different instances of adverse effects, of serious adverse effects as it relates to the vaccine. That was breaking news on every major cable news network. And the issue that I had there was a level of, you know, for me, it wasn't responsible in terms of how it was done. It was breaking news and it was going to get people's attention and it was going to somewhat have a little bit of hysteria attached to it. And I recall watching the stories and anchors saying, this is not something to panic about. This is not something to go crazy about. The vaccines are still safe. Well, then if that's the case, why are you like literally opening up a whole new can of worms by making it breaking news? I'm not saying that it's not a story. I'm saying that the sensationalism that you have placed around the story can be confusing to a lot of folks.
Sure.
For weeks prior to that, many news outlets were saying, it's safe, you need to get vaccinated, you should go do this, everything else, like this is important, herd immunity, we need to get out there. You know, we need to get vaccinated so that we can open back up and be safe around each other and enjoy our summer together. And then for six people, you get this story and it's like, oh my gosh, it's halted. Like don't, you know, like everybody needs to know this, but it's not that big of a deal because it's only six people, so.
Yeah.
Well, which is it? You know what I mean? Like, I think that that's the thing. That's the one piece that I will say is that the tone and its inconsistency and erratic nature sort of created a space that invited a lot of these sort of spooky types of theories. And now, you know, we have a reptile race.
Exactly. And we should all be scared about that. Breaking news, reptiles are among us.
Breaking news, zombie apocalypse of the vaccinated, right? Like easy.
But with scales and forked tongues. And I got J&J, so I'm feeling kind of snaky right now, actually. Anyway, well, you know what? We're gonna get to a little bit more on the vaccine in a sec. I just wanted to touch base with a bit of breaking news. But don't be scared. Don't be scared. But we will turn to our next story now. In the last week, the Dems in the House have put forward their bill to recognize DC as the 51st state. Today, the White House has formally declared its support for the House bill as well, saying it would provide the residents of the district with long overdue full representation in Congress, with the Office of Management and Budget putting out a statement saying establishing the state of Washington, Douglas Commonwealth as the 51st state will make our union stronger and more just. Washington, D.C. has a robust economy, a rich culture, and diverse population of Americans from all walks of life who are entitled to full and equal participation in our democracy. So that's a few different reasons for why the OMB believes that D.C. should be a state, you know, recognition of its important historical position, the people that live there, the sort of foundational American concept of no taxation without representation. On the other hand, the Republicans would counter, no. Why? It would probably help the Democrats or whatever. So it is being pitched as a complete non-starter, Charles. Actually, I don't know what your position on DC statehood is, but right now Biden has weighed in. He supports it, so it automatically becomes a higher profile thing.
I'm for it. I've worked on Capitol Hill. I lived in DC before, and I think that it is a very, very stark example of American hypocrisy to have a city literally where is the capital of your democratic state and the people who live there are not represented in government. It's, you know, it to me was just the basis of the highest level of contrast ever. And I've heard all the arguments about DC being a federal city and sort of existing outside of the realm of, you know, regular America in that regard. And I understand how all of that came to be. However, what I also understand is that DC is a city that has a significant population of black people and other marginalized groups and communities. And it is not by accident that for many years, these cries have gone unheard and unattended to, and that people have made this a non-starter. Consider who lives in DC and consider what the conversation would be like if the people who live in DC now did not. And when I say that, what I'm referring to is the influence of gentrification in different parts of DC. As DC has become less black, this conversation has become louder. When this is not a new conversation for anyone who has followed the news, Eleanor Holmes Norton has talked about this literally for decades. Marion Barry, when he was alive, the former mayor of DC, was something that he pushed for literally for decades, right? The CBC was behind this for decades. This is not a new discussion. What is new is that the demographics of DC have begun to lighten, shall we say. And so now I think there is a greater sense of acceptance around what that could mean and what that could look like. And so people are more engaged for the conversation. It's not a surprise to me that conservatives and Republicans are not interested in that discussion because it doesn't benefit them. However, I do think that this is also similar, not exactly the same, but similar to John Conyers' unending fight to get Congress to study or pay for or fund for the study of reparations, and that the more you continue to beat at the door around an issue, the more of a chance that you may have to actually make some progress at some point, even if it's not something that you see. So for years and years and years, this had been a discussion. It was a non-starter, couldn't get any real support outside of the CBC and literally Eleanor Holmes Norton. And now we're seeing that it's expanding. And I think there are a number of different examples of that, conversations about reparations, right? Conversations, you know, like all of these things are things that we have not seen this type of progress in our national dialogue around before. And it only underscores the need to continue to keep pushing.
Yeah. Well, what you just gave was a nuanced historical argument for why potentially it should be a state and the multi-decade path to get it to be there. As I alluded to, the Republican response is, and you just want it because it's going to be two more Democrats.
John, this is why you bring me on the show for the dragons. It's like nuanced historical argument on 420 while people are getting blazed and stoned out of their mind. I'm sure this sounds like the best melody in their ears that they've ever heard.
I think we've seen the birth of nuanced historical dragon, actually.
Dragon.
Yeah, but like I said, the Republicans just say, no, you want more Dem senators. Okay, so my response to that would be, and this is not gonna be nuanced or historical. You guys say you are, maybe this is historical. You guys say that you are the party of personal responsibility and the bootstraps and you know that frontier spirit of just getting her done and all that. So here's the thing. So you look at DC and you say they generally vote Democratic. And so presumably were you to make a mistake, they would vote for the Democrats. Here's an idea. Take some notes. Come up with some ideas that would appeal to the people that live there. And then maybe they'll vote for you. How about that? How about do something that they would like? And then maybe they'll vote for you. That's not even a part of the conversation. The idea that the Republicans might try to appeal to the people that live there. The people of DC are dead to them. There is no chance whatsoever that they could ever come up with a single idea that would be appealing to them. And that's not me saying that. That is their behavior screaming it. Same for Puerto Rico, hypothetically as well. It is just not even a possibility. There is no world that these people would ever want anything to do with us Republicans. That is what they're saying. So they don't want to say that though. So they have to come up with some argument. So they have come up with one and it is, no, it's too small. DC is too small. And that is kind of a ridiculous argument. Although what if it could be a little bit more immediately ridiculous? Well, they found a way. Here is Representative Mace earlier today making this case.
Certified. We're seeing it now with DC statehood. DC wouldn't even qualify as a singular congressional district, and here they are. They want the power and the authority of being an entire state in the United States, and they want that power.
Okay, so that is Representative Mace, as well as Representative Liz Cheney to her right, and someone I don't know, it doesn't matter. So she's saying, DC, you tiny little baby of an area. You got no people, you got no right. You got balls, I guess, that you want political representation with so few people. We'd never allow that in America, right? Liz Cheney, right? Representative from a state that has 150,000 less people than the District of Columbia.
Right.
Like, and that's the thing. The easy point, as a lot of people have pointed out, is that DC is already bigger than Wyoming. It's also bigger than Vermont. It has 25,000 less people than the entire state of Alaska, which is big on trees and I think puffins, not so much people. It's only got 50,000 less people than North Dakota. All states that Republicans accept deserve political representation. So again, maybe to tie our points together, Charles, maybe it's not about the number of people, maybe it's about the sort of people that's more their problem.
Yeah, I just did a quick search. There's a list of states with a population less than little, small, tiny DC. Wyoming, Vermont, Alaska, North Dakota, South Dakota, and yeah, they're estimating that Delaware is like on par.
All states that get senators, by the way.
Yeah. So, like, you know, that argument is just complete. And I'm actually surprised that people's communications folks have not really considered, like, hey, listen, you're about to advance an argument that doesn't make sense. But, you know, maybe that's too much like right. But at the same time, it just doesn't bode well in terms of the type of politics and dog whistles that we have been seeing from the right for a very long time. In terms of, again, when the last time I was here, you may recall, I talked a bit about the difference between white supremacy and white nationalism. This is white nationalism. That's what this is. This is white nationalism. DC has a significantly high population of black and brown people, but specifically black people, right? And so the idea that we would give them more access to government when they currently have less access to government is problematic for a lot of people, because those people fundamentally believe and ideologically believe that those are not people who are supposed to be participating in America's political processes, because they're not intended to serve them.
100%. Well, look, I know we've only got 10 more minutes with Charles. So I think we can fit in one more topic, and we will return to the always fun topic of anti-vax propaganda. We can't necessarily fit on the show every bit of crazy anti-vax stuff, but sometimes it rises to a level where I feel like we just gotta say something. So why don't we turn to this next topic? Fox News isn't satisfied to just have Tucker Carlson do an hour of scaremongering around the vaccine. They also like to bring in experts. And one of the experts that they've brought in several times to talk about this is Dr. Naomi Wolf. So Dr. Naomi Wolf has been on multiple times to say that Fauci's not qualified to talk about any of this and that you shouldn't get the vaccine. She is very worried about the side effects. What she thinks is happening to the people who got the vaccine is, I would say, a little bit outside of the norm, a little bit outside of the scientific consensus. So here's a recent tweet of hers. Hundreds of women on this page say they are having bleeding clotting after vaccination, or that they are bleed oddly being around vaccinated women. Unconfirmed, needs more investigation, but lots of reports. So she admits unconfirmed, needs more investigation, which presumably means having more people post at the Facebook site that she had linked to, which I swear to God, the group's name is All Vaccines Are Fake. That is the name of the group. So to be clear, it's not just that women might get clots. It's that if you're near vaccinated women, you might get clots.
You haven't heard,
Charles. Neither of us. You've heard of this phenomenon?
Yeah, it's they call it like the reverse vampire. So I do want to talk really quickly about how we got to this space. There is a conversation around the death of expertise that I think has not gotten enough attention in today's society. The benefit of the internet is that information is widely available to many people, and the downside to that is that misinformation is equally as widely available to many people. And when people do not have the requisite amount of respect for actual experts and experts' opinions, right? Like, this is what we have, right? So for my thing in my career, I am a lawyer. People will try to argue with me about the law despite having not gone to law school or anything of the effect. Now, here's the thing. I can completely understand that you may read something or see something or make an interpretation about something that seems to be contrary to common sense. And so you will read a law or interpret something and then come to me and say, hey, when I read this, this seemed this way. But when I respond to you and I tell you, actually, no, that's not how it works in real life because of X, Y, Z, so on and so forth. That's the point, that you accept what the expert has said. So with a lot of these anti-vaccination people, they're not scientists, they're not doctors. They're not people who have any real medical background whatsoever. They're just reading the ingredients or the components of different vaccines, some of which are not even accurate, and saying, why would you put mercury in your body? Why would you do this? Why would you, you know, this is terrible, so on and so. They haven't conducted experiment the first. No, they wouldn't even know how to conduct a proper experiment and monitor the effects of a vaccine. And yet and still, they have built a movement because there is no respect for science and expertise. And I think the longer that we're in that space, the more of these sort of kooky theories that you're going to see, where it's like every opinion, unfortunately, John, is not of equal weight in every conversation, right? Like, I should not be weighing in on a vaccine conversation in terms of like, take it, don't take it, whatever, because I'm not a scientist. I just, all I have is an opinion. It's just like a regular, there are regular opinions and there are expert opinions. When it comes to like topics like these, let's leave them to the experts, please.
Sure. I literally only have opinions and not expert ones, but I do have a lot of them and I like them a lot. But anyway, as you said, there's the death of expertise, I think is totally true. I think that Fox has contributed to it about as much as anyone. While still, they train people to not care about academic work, not care about advanced degrees and all the research and everything. But you'll note that they're bringing Dr. Naomi Wolf on because they want to pretend that they care about this stuff. Scott Atlas comes on as a doctor. He doesn't know anything about viruses and, you know, vaccines and all that, but they like the idea of it. They bring on that Berenson guy as a former New York Times reporter or whatever. But wait, the New York Times is fake news. Why are you using that as a credential? But we know why they're doing it. And the issue here is that Naomi Wolf is out of her mind that she thinks my blood senses that your blood has a vaccine, starts clotting. I'm not a doctor, but that's dumb. It's just dumb. And a day after she posted that, they had her on Fox News primetime to talk about Anthony Fauci, about lockdowns. That's crazier than anything I've ever said. And she got brought on the news a day after. Not despite it, but because of it. To say that Fauci doesn't give us fact-based, science-based guidance. You believe in psychic blood, then you want to talk about science-based whatever. It's just absolute nonsense. But and again, we don't cover all the anti-vax stuff, but it's not just, it used to be, don't take the vaccine because it's got mercury and it'll have a side effect or whatever. Now it's Tucker Carlson saying, don't take the vaccine because it has side effects and also it doesn't work. Or her saying, don't take the vaccine because if you're a woman, you're gonna miscarry because of this. And in fact, go out there and pressure people you know to not get the vaccine because they'll make you miscarry if they get the vaccine. This is way beyond normal anti-vax stuff. This is truly sick misinformation designed to get people to not only endanger themselves, but now put pressure on their family and friends to make sure that they stay in danger.
I agree. I think that this is something that, you know, really is dangerous in terms of the irresponsible messaging around this. And ultimately, the fact that, you know, I have to say, and I'm very careful about this. I do appreciate this platform and I don't want to get anybody in any trouble. But I do think that, like, on a certain level, this is exploitative. It exploits the level of ignorance. It's not even gullibility, but just sort of like a void of critical thought in American society. And that is, to me, unethical. And it rises to the level of being deeply problematic, because what we have to understand is that there is a very, very clear link between the disregard for facts, science, and expertise, and the ability to put forth crazy conspiracy theories, and what happened on January 6th. And people don't sort of understand that. They don't understand that, like, when you create an environment that is primed for these types of crazy theories and no respect for actual authority, whether it's expert authority or legal authority, processes, whether it's actually testing, white papers, research, other things of that nature, or an election for that matter, that there are consequences because people listen to your words and they take them in and they have real actual impact. And so while you and I may have a very reasoned and understanding conversation about it, where we can both sort of laugh and chuckle at the absolute absurdity of this, it's important that we keep in mind that like there are people who are buying this hook, line, and sinker. And they're making decisions that are going to be hard for themselves and other people around them. And when we have outlets, media outlets that have impact, like a Fox News, that's just unacceptable. Because the impact is really real. And if you ever underestimated what that impact can look like, look no further than what we saw in the Capitol in January 6th. I know that people may think that's a bit of a stretch, but is it though? Is it really a stretch to allow for kooky theories and QAnon folks and Jewish space lasers and everything else to be a part of the dialogue and then wonder why certain people act on them? Why is that such a stretch? Because it isn't.
I agree. Unfortunately, that is all the time that we have with Charles. Charles, I want to thank you as always for joining us. Had a great time. Really appreciate your perspective. Until next time, though, where can people follow you?
John, so much. So glad to have me. So glad to be had, and so glad that you guys. I appreciate it. Always really enjoyed coming on the show and co-hosting.
Thank you.
Folks can find me on Twitter at CF Coleman Jr. That's CF Coleman Jr. On Facebook, Charles F. Coleman Jr. I'm still a dinosaur. I still do use Facebook. I'm on IG. I need to get my IG followers up. So please follow me on Twitter and my Twitter followers up. So please follow me on Twitter and IG. Like Facebook, I know nobody uses it but me. So if you want to look me up, that's fine. But on IG, it's CFC40_official. Again, that's C as in Charles, F as in F, C as in Coleman, 40. _official on IG, or you can just look me up by my name and you'll find me. So awesome. I appreciate you guys and thanks again for having me. I truly enjoyed it.
Thank you, Charles. Hope to talk to you soon.
Take care, John.
Okay, everyone. Well, unfortunately, that was all the time we had with Charles, but we do have a little bit more time. So assuming the producer will allow it, can we do our next story at least? We're good? Okay, awesome. Okay, I'm gonna inflict this on the audience right now. So let's jump into this. Donald Trump appeared on Fox News and he seemed bewildered by something that he's seen out there in the country. For some reason, some Republicans not that excited about taking the vaccine. Listen to the former president here.
You know, they all want me to do a commercial because a lot of our people don't want to take vaccine. You know, I don't know what that is exactly. Republican, I don't know what it is.
You encourage people to get it.
I encourage them to take it, I do. But they want me to make a
vaccine. Did you get it?
Yes, I did. I had it and I took it, okay?
You got both.
Because I believe. So here's the thing. They want me to do a commercial saying, take the vaccine.
Wow.
And they think that's very important and I'd certainly do it. But then I call them, I say, let me ask you a question. You just did something, 6 people out of 8 million people. Somebody said that Tylenol, women's birth control, all cause far more. 6 people
out of 7
experienced
million.
Some difficulty. Mm. 6 people, and that's too bad. It's terrible. But they paused it. That's the worst thing you could have done from a public relations standpoint. They paused Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And it probably even affects the other vaccines a little bit. I think it's very suspect as what they did with Johnson & Johnson, because the only people that are happy about that are Pfizer and Moderna. The only people that are happy about that, because what they did is a terrible, terrible thing.
Okay, so I agree with him on one point, which I will turn to, but let's just do a bit of fact checking. It's Pfizer. It just is. It's Pfizer, not Pfizer. He said it over and over. It's really weird. Also, on the pre-show, we talked about Republicans heading down to Mar-a-Lago and saying, like, no, you guys don't understand. We've been hanging out with Trump and he is ready to go back on the campaign trail. He's ditched the spray tan. He's been getting real sun. He's been dropping weight from all the golf. That looked like a fake tan to me. And he looks like hell. I'm just gonna say he looks like hell, but that's just me. Like I said earlier, I'm not an expert and I just have my opinions. That said, He thinks that people should take the vaccine. And he is one of the most influential people in this country. That is a sick, weird place we've ended up in as a society, but he is. And he's saying it on Sean Hannity. Now, he has put out multiple statements in the past saying, I want you to take this vaccine, but Fox won't cover it. Even though every one of them has gotten the vaccine, including Sean Hannity, they won't cover it. Well, when he shows up on there and he says it, they don't have to cover it, it's there. And so hopefully that gets through to somebody. I also kind of agree with him on Johnson & Johnson. As we've said, I'm not a doctor. I don't know about any of this stuff. I have, however, watched every episode of House, and so that gives me some base level of expertise. And they paused with very few instances of those blood clots. Now, they did what they think is responsible, and apparently the American people agree, because a poll today shows that 88% of the country thinks that it was the responsible thing to do to pause it. Additionally, 91% of respondents knew about the pause, which, as they point out in the sort of summary of the poll, is generally a higher level of information than people's understanding of who won the Super Bowl like the week after. So lots of people knew about it. They thought it was a good idea. My fear, and I think he sort of expresses this in his weird rambling thing, we cut that down, it's insanely rambling and crazy, but is that people might come out of this with an increased level of vaccine hesitancy. So I have been wondering, are we gonna have evidence with which to evaluate if that's happening? And we kind of do. So in this poll, we're gonna show you a chart that is, God help you if you're on mobile to understand what's going on here, but take a look at this. So how likely are you to get the vaccine? This is updated information for after the pause. The not at all likely number is, they summarize it as about 30%, which they say is about where it was at in early March. So from before the pause to after the pause, it doesn't seem like the number has shot up. But there's a fight going on online right now about whether that's actually as good of a thing as it seems. So look, it's good that the number hasn't gone up, but understand the number doesn't have much room to go up anymore because millions and millions of people have been vaccinated in that time. My fear is that the number is still 30% after months of vaccinations. Now, maybe that doesn't make sense on its face, but the idea is some people are gonna be hesitant to get the vaccine, not because they've always been against vaccines, but because it's new. And so what they want is time and people being vaccinated so they can look at it and say, is this safe? Does it seem to be working? And we have had many, many people getting vaccinated for literally months now. And yet almost one out of three Americans still say they're not gonna get vaccinated. That one out of three, by the way, depending on how many of them have already gotten COVID, and they're probably overrepresented, means that we might not be able to reach herd immunity. Certainly not in the short term, if one out of three people could get the vaccine and choose not to. So look, there's good news in this chart, but there's also bad news. And it might be really bad news if that is enough Americans out there that keep getting and spreading COVID, that new variants of it can develop, potentially variants that might actually be able to bust their way through some or all of the vaccines that we have. So again, that is why, as much as I despise Donald Trump, and you know that I do, I have been going out of my way to give him credit when he tells people to do the right thing. Even if it's in the middle of a monologue with these insane conspiracy theories about how like the government is working with Pfizer, and that's why they're screwing over Johnson & Johnson by shutting it down. It's all madness. But at the end, he is saying, I got the vaccine, you should get the vaccine, and that is a good thing. And by the way, if you do track down his full interview, there's one added little extra bit of fun there. Sean Hannity, kind of a dunce, and he's not reading off a teleprompter, so he doesn't know exactly what he's supposed to say. And so once he gets past a North Korean level of compliments to Donald Trump, they start talking about how Americans get charged more for certain medicine than they do in other countries. And they do a close up on Sean Hannity's face where he says, why do they get to charge us more? And I just think, man, that's a moment where Sean Hannity's like almost learning or evolving. Like, yeah, the pharmaceutical companies screw us over, and it's kind of a problem, Sean. Maybe look into it with your nightly news show and your massive budget and production staff. Doubt he's gonna dwell on that thought or even return to it. But anyway, Donald Trump, thank you sort of for maybe getting through to some of your followers. We will have to see. Unfortunately, that's going to be all the time we have, because I don't think I necessarily have enough time with the limited time we have remaining to do our last topic. So it will be brought back for tomorrow. Big News Wednesdays with J.R. Jackson. Before we go, though, I did want to let you know once again, on Thursday after the Young Turks postgame show, stick around, because myself, Cenk, Anna Bendixson, Ida Rodriguez, people from the Sunrise Movement, Brett Ehrlich, a whole bunch of fun for Earth Day, our big Earth Day special, where we are going to be talking about what's been done on the interview or on the environment, what remains to be done. Is there a chance of us getting the Green New Deal? How would that happen if it does happen? We're going to be having a lot of fun talking about international environmental news as well, like truly talking about the Earth. And so hope that you can join us there. We're doing a lot of work in advance of it, and we're getting a bunch of great people together, so it should be fun. Hope that you enjoy it. And with that, let me read just a, wait, what am I missing? Oh, I did not know. I did not actually know. What do you know? You all are in for a treat, because in just about 20 minutes on Twitch, at twitch.tv/TYT, Jordan Yule is once again gonna dive deep. It's a particular sort of news. If you're on Twitch, you know what kind of news that is. So, oh my, so he too, in honor of Earth Day, is having an awesome guest from the Sunrise Movement. So you know it's gonna be fun. So head over to twitch.tv/TYT after this program, and Jordan will be there. And with that, no, I did wanna read a couple of super chats, and I think we have a couple of minutes, so I am gonna do that. Stop throwing me off. I can see out of the corner of my eye. Anyway, Lennon O'Brien, thank you for becoming a tier one member. Really do appreciate that. Ben had a comment for Charles saying Charles is great. It's good to see more black progressives on public platforms. Thank you, Ben. I appreciate that. Let's see. Nick Rohr says, got my first Pfizer. P.S. You pronounced my last name right. No extra sound. Good. I think I did it there. We also, interestingly, Pfizer does have an sound at the end, Donald Trump. Maybe try to use it in the future. Anyway, non-human humanist says, oh, I am not gonna be alone. Other non-humans gonna join me. Me, a legal alien here, some alien money. Thank you, non-human humanist. I appreciate that. Lawrence Wells says, hello, John and Charles. Clearly the vaccine is a Dalek plot to mutate humans to repopulate after the last time war. Ben isn't on. Keep your Doctor Who stuff to yourself. Anyway, are advocates for Anglo-Saxon traditions bringing back paganism or druidism? Nope, it's just the white nationalist stuff. Mary Hooker Meyer says, I love Charles, he's awesome. Please have him back on regularly. We plan to, thank you for that. Forbzilla says, John, Alaska has an F ton of moose and bears. That is what we're known for. Also the midnight sun, just saying, also in love with Charles. Thank you for those Alaska facts. Hashtag Alaska facts. And Tracy Thomas says, I have heart disease and want to know which vaccine is the safest. Which vaccine should I go for? J&J seems not to be the choice, although locally that's what we have. Tracy, considering your heart disease, that is a great question to ask. And you have asked literally the person least well equipped to give you advice for that. I wouldn't even try, but I'm sure the information is online. Thank you for your faith in me, but it is misplaced. Anyway, okay, Library Dragon says, Naomi Wolf's The Beauty Myth was one of the first pieces of feminist lit I ever read when I first started getting into politics. Her anti-vax turn has been incredibly disappointing. Yes, Library Dragon, I think a lot of people went on that exact same journey with you. It's been a weird couple of decades for Naomi Wolf. Herzog says, blazed. So here's a fun but shallow comment. Charles, love your smile, fantastic teeth. John, miss your cussing from pre-shows, damn you, YouTube. Thank you for those facts. Those are teeth facts, actually. Hashtag teeth facts. Panda says, I'm pregnant and my doctor is doing a trial for pregnant women in the Pfizer one. I don't qualify because I'm diabetic and my numbers aren't great, but it's going good. And he says, I really should get it. Well, maybe they will change that advice at some point. And hopefully you'll be safe either way if you can't get it. Oh, one final comment from Bart. He says, John, I finally got my second dose of Moderna last Friday. One of the advantages is I can now interlink with the Jewish Space Laser Station. So if you need me to heat up your Pop-Tarts via the laser beams, just let me know. Or if anyone from the Dragon Squad needs a light for 420, drop me a line. Happy 420 Dragon Squad. Happy 420, Bart, and to the Dragon Squad. Hope that you have a great holiday. Join me tomorrow for Big News Wednesdays. And either way, you got Deep Dive coming up next with Jordan Ewell. So until next time, stay safe out there, stay sane out there. I'll see you soon.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.